This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The prison population in the United States has skyrocketed over the last five decades. Although the United States makes up just 5% of the world's population, America holds 25% of the world prison population. African Americans are incarcerated at nearly six times the rate of whites. According to one report, if African American and Hispanics were incarcerated at the same rate as whites, today's prison and jail population would decline by about 50%. It is a complicated problem that has devastated many poor communities across the country. Experts gather in Cary this week for a symposium entitled Understanding and Dismantling Mass Incarceration: What Solutions Exist for North Carolina. The symposium is at full capacity now, but you can find out details about mass incarceration at our website, stateofthings.org, and we will talk with some of the participants today. I'm joined by James Williams, who is a public defender in Orange County. Hello, James.
Hello, Frank.
Good to have you back on the program. Heather Thompson is with us. Heather is a professor of Afro-American Studies at the University of Michigan. Hello, Heather.
How are you?
Good. It's good to have you on the program. James, let me start with you to get a picture here in North Carolina. How would you characterize the state of mass incarceration in this state?
Well, I think in the state of North Carolina, just like in all states across this country, people are incarcerated at unprecedented rates, and particularly when you compare the rates with Western nations and basically the nations of the world. The incarceration rate for North Carolina, the last time I checked, is most in line with Russia. And I think in most respects we prefer to see ourselves as a step or two ahead when it comes to liberty and freedoms and basic rights as compared with Russia. So we have a number of people in prisons and jails. But beyond that, Frank, multiple hundreds more people who are impacted by criminal records that prevent them from being able to succeed in life, whether it be through schools or through finding jobs or housing. People's lives are adversely impacted by this incarceration fetish that we've been on in this country for at least the past four decades.
Well, let's find out how that happened, when we took that turn, and how it got so bad. Heather, you've looked into this. Take us back to maybe 1965, somewhere in the 60s, or the beginning of this radical upturn in the incarceration rates. What are the roots of this?
Well, I think the first thing that we need to understand, which will give us a great deal of strength to change things as they are today, is that we chose this policy. This was not a policy that was dictated by necessity. We did not have historically remarkable crime rates when we began the apparatus that allowed us to wage such a historic war on crime, which was really the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration of the Johnson administration. And we really chose this as a policy response to a great deal of civil rights upheaval in this country. And interestingly, of course, many southern states had responded to civil rights protests by equating protesters with criminals and deciding that that kind of protest was criminal in intent. When the civil rights movement comes north, this is the conclusion drawn by many northern politicians as well. And so we begin to criminalize particularly poor spaces of color in completely new ways. And the crime rate begins to go up, and we just add to that war on crime with the war on drugs and by criminalizing school spaces. And it just becomes a freight train out of control. But it's important to realize that we didn't start this because we were in a crime crisis. And indeed, by choosing this for political reasons, it seems very apt that we can now come together politically and unchoose it.
What are some of the ways in which the law has changed? What did we start criminalizing that hadn't been, as you say, in some ways in response to the Civil Rights Act?
Well, one way to think about it, which is an interesting historical connection, is that right after the American Civil War, We did something very similarly across the South. For example, we had a whole spate of new laws that criminalized behavior of poor people, particularly poor black people, and also made much higher penalties for things that had already been illegal, say, for example, stealing a pig. And overnight, Southern prisons went from being all white to all black, not because, of course, whites stopped committing crimes and blacks started committing them excessively, but because of a change in policy. Same thing happens really after the Civil War. We begin to decide that, for example, drug addiction was much more of a criminal problem than a health problem, right? Rather than dealing with it through the public health system, we decided to deal with it through the criminal justice system. So much higher penalties for being a drug addict and drug possession, much higher penalties for very basic things, things that you would normally think of as even just bad social graces, like urinating in public or sleeping outside because you're homeless. And so we begin to criminalize these spaces, you know, in wholesale ways, both for minor infractions, but also real public health crises.
Yeah. Thing that Heather just mentioned, the Civil War and right after the Civil War. And, of course, you know, this is 2015 and it's the 150-year anniversary of the end of the Civil War, mm-hmm. but also the 150-year anniversary of the passage of the 13th Amendment. And one thing that Southerners took advantage of was that clause in the 13th Amendment that said that, you know, slavery was, you know, involuntary servitude was ended, except as it might relate to someone convicted of a crime or convicted of a felony. And so you have a number of people, I think, looking at studies that, you know, some of these laws were changed to take advantage of that. But also, the other thing that she mentioned was 1965. This is 50-year anniversary of actually the passage of, I think, the Law Enforcement Assistance Act, which, again, was a predecessor to a number of federal laws and statutes that have, since 1965, led to or helped create this mass incarceration that we see today. Which is coincidentally, so we had the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965. Right. We had just had the passage of the Civil Rights Act, and we started on a path that would undo the benefits of a lot of that legislation by this war on crime and eventual war on drugs.
Well, I want to talk to Heather about that very point, the kind of coincidence of any advance made in civil rights for African Americans being countered by changes in the law. So we see it in 65 after the Civil Rights Act, criminalization of activities that might be found in poor neighborhoods. We saw it in 2008, the election of a black man, and suddenly southern states begin restricting their voter laws. And we have the most restrictive law in the country now here in North Carolina after a black man is elected. So is there the same correlation kind of across the board between advances in civil rights and restriction and a more repressive criminal system, Heather?
Well, it's certainly the case that the civil rights advances of African-Americans and also Latinos in this country has generated alarm bells for other parts of society. And one of the responses to that has been to make sure that political power does not shift into the hands of those people who are newly empowered. So I don't think it's not conspiratorial. It's just it's a very interesting interplay of politics that the same year we get the Voting Rights Act, we also begin the war on crime. And of course, over time, through felon disfranchisement, we undo many of the potential gains that the Voting Rights Act would have made. Felon disfranchisement today is a huge problem. It has distorted our democracy without question, just as it did after the Civil War. Because remember, the other 19th century corollary, not only did we criminalize spaces in new ways, but of course we took away people's right to vote. And as James said, we put them to work. And so a very similar phenomenon develops here. And so we have a situation where we are indeed a country that elects a black mayor, but we do so at a time when we have gutted the Black community's gains in so many other key respects. And I think it's really important to mention that this is a bipartisan effort that got us into this mess. You know, we think of Reagan's drug war, we think of the Bush administration, but we also need to think about the Clinton's 1994 crime bill, which was, you know, really draconian in its impact, and again, beginning this with Johnson. So I think all hands are quite messy with this, and again, this invites us to think about the solutions in a bipartisan fashion as well.
Well, the other thing you talked about, President Clinton, and that those drug policies, mandatory sentencing as well. You know what the defenders of all of this will say, who say mass incarceration is not an issue because, in fact, the crime rate has gone down, so it's working, whatever it is, Heather.
Well, I would love to speak to that because I do think, and I think this is something we'll discuss tomorrow at the symposium, but I'd love all of the listeners to really understand that this is just it's just not the case. It is the case that we have locked up more citizens than any other country on the globe. It is not the case that that is what accounts for a lowered crime rate. In fact, I was on a recent two-year study team that caught, you know, examined in, you know, crucial detail the relationship between incarceration rates and crime rates. And we cannot explain the overall drop in crime with the rise in incarceration. And in fact, to the extent that they're related, I would invite viewers to consider that high rates of incarceration have had a devastating effect on our already most fragile communities and indeed have increased violence. So that, in fact, if we want a safer community, mass incarceration has done exactly the opposite of what we would want. Just by the way, as prohibition...
You know what, Heather? I tell you what. Forgive me for interrupting, but I need to take a break right now. And when we come back, I'll have you continue that thought, and we will continue our conversation about mass incarceration today on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, looking at mass incarceration today on The State of Things. James Williams is with me. He's a public defender in Orange County. Heather Thompson is a professor of Afro-American Studies at the University of Michigan. We're joined now by Tamar Burkhead, who is a professor of law at UNC Chapel Hill. She's going to be a speaker at Thursday's Mass Incarceration Symposium. And with us here today, Tamar Burkhead, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Good to be here, Frank.
Heather, just before the break, you were saying, talking about the statistics that show, you know, a correlation between increased mass incarceration, decreased crime rates. You say they're not related. And in fact, the devastating effect that mass incarceration has had on poor communities has had a reverse effect. And you were about to make another point, I think.
Well, I mean, just that we need to not think that incarceration is what explains the fact that the violent crime rate or the crime rate in general has gone down. We looked at this very closely. They are disaggregated, even with the incapacitative effect, meaning you can't commit a crime if you're locked up. That still does not have a significant enough impact to explain the crime drop. So that's an interesting question, why we had the crime drop. But meanwhile, we know, and this is really important, it's an incentive for changing this policy, we know that areas that have been intensely incarcerated have suffered mightily, and that, in fact, the safety has gone down in those communities. And I was just saying we shouldn't be surprised. We know that, for example, during Prohibition, that when we outlawed alcohol, we made those communities incredibly dangerous because the trade in alcohol became very dangerous. So the drug war has actually created violence, and mass incarceration has not created a safer society.
And when we talk about mass incarceration, we're thinking about adults, but it gets started much earlier than that. And tomorrow, I know that you've been interested in something we call the school-to-prison pipeline, that some of the structures that are in place that lead to mass incarceration actually begin right in our schools.
Yes, that's absolutely the case, Frank. The school-to-prison pipeline refers to the process in which typical adolescent behavior, teen behavior that occurs in schools is criminalized. Instead of school administrators addressing it within the confines of the school building with disciplinary processes, the cases and the children are referred to the court system, either the juvenile court or the criminal court.
And you're saying that there are a lot of policies, again, that are responsible for the zero tolerance policies, more police in the schools, all those things. How did that start? When did we begin doing that?
Well, as far as I can tell, in the 50s was the time when police officers first entered many schools, and it was in the spirit of improving community relations. But by the 1990s, with the so-called era of the super predator, this concept that youth crime was intense and we needed to do something drastic about it, then more and more police officers were placed in school settings. And then with Columbine, the Columbine school shooting in 1999, that just exacerbated at least the perception that there was a lot of violence going on in schools. And I think between 1999 and 2005, the U.S. Department of Justice gave something like $750 million in grants to schools to do things like hire what we call school resource officers, place law enforcement in schools, so that by 2005, across the country, there were about 6,500 new school resource officers in our country schools.
And we see the statistics, and again, in terms of disparity, are overwhelming and troubling, the ways in which African-American, particularly African-American men, are disparately punished, suspended, and often expelled from school. And of course, there's a pretty close correlation between suspension, expulsion, and contact with the criminal justice system.
Yes, absolutely. When you have high suspension rates in a school, typically those schools are also underfunded, and they are schools that don't have basic supports in place for children and families in need, such as school social workers, school nurses, school counselors, and then combining that with high-stakes testing, you give schools an inherent incentive to push out students who are struggling, and invariably there's a disproportionate number of those students who are poor and who are children of color.
So we can see how all of these decisions, as Heather said at the top of our show, Heather Thompson, look, we made this so that we can undo it. All these decisions add up to great disparities in the way the criminal justice system operates. And then what you find, of course, is that prosecutors and police seem offended when you say, well, look at these statistics, and they say, but I'm not that way. That happened in Milwaukee, and we're talking about mass incarceration today, and we've been paying a lot of attention to legislation and police, but prosecutors do play a big part in who gets to go to jail. DAs choose whether or not to prosecute defendants in the first place, whether the crime is a misdemeanor or a felony, and then what plea deal, what that might look like. John Chisholm is a district attorney of Milwaukee County, Wisconsin, and he was disturbed by the disparate rates of incarceration in his jurisdiction. Wisconsin has one of the biggest racial disparities in the country. And a 2010 study showed that 13% of that state's African-American men were behind bars, and that is nearly double the national average. So John Chisholm opened up his office to an outside group called the Vera Institute of Justice. And that group analyzes the way police and prosecutors do their work, and they're looking for the roots of racial disparity. So interestingly enough, John Chisholm said that overall, Vera found that there was no significant, or at least significant, disparity in the rates at which blacks and whites were charged. But then they drilled down, and they found that African Americans were charged at far higher rates for certain kinds of crimes, specifically low-level drug crimes. I spoke with John Chisholm earlier this week, and I asked him how the Vera study helped him.
What they wanted to do is really show you how you could analyze these things and figure out why would things like this happen. And in that process, for example, one of the case studies was on possession of drug paraphernalia, which is one of the most minor drug offenses that you could commit. And what they found, of course, is that oftentimes the people being arrested for possession of drug paraphernalia had been arrested many, many times for low-level drug offenses. And so a young prosecutor looking at just a criminal record, not even accounting for race, but just looking at a criminal record, would look at the offense and say, well, the person has been charged a number of times, been arrested multiple times, so of course I'm going to charge it again. And when you step back from that and spoke to the more experienced prosecutors in the office, they would say, why are we charging those in the first place? Well, that's a clear sign of drug addiction if you're walking around with drug paraphernalia. And shouldn't we be advocating more for diverting individuals like that into a treatment program or some not wasting criminal justice resources on such a low-level offense? And that's just one example that came out of it. And so it wasn't what came out of it was not that anybody was making any decisions based on perceptions of race, but the impact was clearly differential and significantly so.
I think that's one of the most interesting things about what you have chosen to do. And I would say it's courageous because for so many offices, anybody kind of in your position, it always feels like an accusation, an indictment that somehow you, your department, whether it's prosecutors or police, are somehow fundamentally racist. But you're saying that's not what you're finding here. And just by asking these folks in to do the analysis, that's not the problem. The problem is often very different.
That's exactly right. And it's a twofold challenge. It's an internal argument that has to be had, because that's exactly right. People that enter into any kind of public service do so with the very best of intentions, and they're oftentimes not well paid. They are doing it because they have a genuine commitment to serving their community. They're not doing things intentionally to cause a adverse effect for one group over the other. They are all convinced that they're doing their very best to be fair and impartial. But there's so many dynamics that go into any individual case, and obviously if you're encountering a population that's been challenged just across the host of different areas and rely on police intervention on a regular basis, then oftentimes they're going to be coming into our system more and more often. But then the second thing that they did very well is they actually went out to the community and spoke to influential leaders in our community in a forum that allowed them to say, look, there aren't a lot of prosecutors willing to do this. It's considered risky to do this, because if the information comes out that shows disparity, people may very well say, aha, we knew that this was going on. And what their point to the community was, give them a chance.
Well, have you made any changes, policy changes, and have the outcomes changed?
Oh, no question about it. So this was actually the beginning of a process, and that's what I have to tell other prosecutors all the time, is there's no magic bullets here. This is a complicated. What you learn quickly is that you become dependent on so many other parts of the system if you're going to affect change. That means that you have to, for example, open up the level of resourcing and integration for things like pretrial services. So when a person's arrested and they're evaluated, you have to use the proper tools to figure out, you know, what's their risk and what's their need. And then you have to have the resources to put them in places that will actually address the problem. If they're drug addicted, if they're mentally ill, if they're alcohol dependent, if they're a youthful offender, all of these are categories that you know, if you just take a sort of a assembly line approach, those tend to be the individuals that disproportionately come into the system. The public defenders had to change the way they did business. That required them, for example, to put resources in right at the front end. And we have teams now that you know, talk about whether a person's appropriate to be diverted out of the system or put into drug treatment court or given some kind of alternative. They do so right from the moment the case is first presented. Mm-hmm. What we want to do is front load it and say, can't we make a lot of these decisions a lot quicker? And that means that we have to provide them with police reports and things like that right away. That means that they in turn have to oftentimes advocate for their clients that they accept responsibility and take advantage of the programming that's available right from the start.
And you're getting better outcomes?
We are getting better outcomes, and the most significant, when they studied after we'd been doing it for about 5 years, what we saw is that the incarceration rate for African-American males from Milwaukee dropped dramatically. In fact, it dropped to mid-1990 levels, and it's continued since that time. And so is it directly attributable? No. There are so many other factors that go into it, but it's a significant part of the puzzle of reducing the number of people that go in the system. And I'll note that during this exact same time period, we saw significant reductions in violent crime in our community.
So the incarceration rate went down and the crime rate went down.
That's exactly right. Now, we're in a period of an uptick in violent crime in Milwaukee, and I make that perfectly clear that this is not something that, like I said, is a magic bullet. You have to constantly engage in figuring out what's going on there. But for the first evaluation of this, we've seen significant reductions, particularly in that category that caused us the greatest concern, is the number of lower-level drug offenders that were going into the prison system.
John, thank you so much for talking with us.
I'm happy to do it.
John Chisholm is the District Attorney of Milwaukee County, Wisconsin. We're talking about mass incarceration today in the state of North Carolina. James Williams is with me. He's a public defender in Orange County. Would much of what John Chisholm said work in North Carolina?
I think so. And the thing that strikes me most about what he said is the collaborative approach. I mean, I think if we are going to impact mass incarceration in North Carolina, we're going to need the cooperation, and we're going to need prosecutors at the table. We're going to need judges at the table. We're going to need defense attorneys and public defenders at the table trying to come up with solutions and ways to address this. And that's the thing that I've been stressing, and that NCCRED, the North Carolina Commission on Racial and Ethnic Disparity, has been stressing. And that's what this symposium on Thursday is an effort to reach all segments of criminal justice stakeholders to try to agree that, first of all, that mass incarceration is something that is a problem that needs to be addressed, and that we should have the wherewithal and the will to begin a collaborative process to come up with some solutions.
Yeah, but Tamar Burkhead, James Williams talks about collaboration. It is an adversarial system. Where does collaboration fit into that?
Well, it's a necessity. We have to, as John Chisholm made clear, we have to acknowledge that mass incarceration is a problem of the system, and in order to change both the levels of incarceration and the disproportionate impact on communities of color, we have to work together and be committed to changing the culture.
Heather Thompson, the we in this is the critical question. Those of us who are paying for this and are by our tax dollars and in communities where we're being disproportionately hurt, that I heard that we in Tamar's statement. But it strikes me that there's another we that might be benefiting from all of this. As you say, it's not conspiratorial, but is there resistance to this? Is there another we that doesn't want to see this happen, this kind of change?
Well, I think there is, although I have to say, the more I've been around the country talking with folks, I do think we are in a moment where there's a lot of goodwill. I think there's a lot of support from many different quarters to end this, because I think there's a real recognition that this is a crisis. And whether or not one is personally affected by it, when you've created a system that, you know, in effect destroys communities and undermines the economy and literally distorts the democracy, then it becomes something that everyone has a stake in fixing. That said, for certain parties, namely companies that build prisons and service prisons, this is a bit of a hard sell. And I think, in fact, to the extent that they are considering getting on board with this, many of them are trying to think about, are there ways to perhaps shift profits to maybe the reentry sector or something like that. But it's a bit grim when you consider that certain people do, in fact, profit off of, the high rates of incarceration of certain communities. And that's through everything. That's through, again, the building of prisons, but also just the servicing of them. You know, everything from selling tampons to tasers to telephones. It's a really kind of icky way to make money, but certainly people do, and they need to be brought to this discussion as well, because they are going to be resistant to change.
Well, I have very little time left, but I do want to bring Dennis Gaddy into our conversation, albeit very late into this conversation. Dennis is Executive Director of Community Success Initiative. He has also had contact, been part of the criminal justice system himself in his personal history, now tries to help people reenter. And I wonder, Dennis, if you can give us briefly some of the challenges of reentry.
Well, one of the things that is a major problem with people coming out of incarceration, Frank, is that this whole issue of collateral consequences. So if a person has already done the time that the judge has asked them to do, and then, of course, that's front-end sentencing. But, of course, when you can't find a job when you get out of prison, that's almost having a sentence on the back end as well, right? So the big four challenges that people face when they're coming out of jobs and housing and education and human services. And if a person has a job, that's the greatest chance for him not going back to prison. So but then, of course, society makes it hard to do the right thing. So if you make it hard to do the right thing, you make it easy to do the wrong thing. So you've got this tsunami of people coming out of prison now, over 700,000 people each year for the next 10 years because of this war on drugs that went and this war on crime that was imposed in the 80s and 90s and 2000s. People didn't talk about what would happen when people come home. That was so kind of hell-bent, I guess, on locking people up that they didn't ever talk about the back end of people coming out. So now we've got this tsunami of people coming out of prison that if we don't do anything about it, the recidivism rate will cause kind of public safety issues that we need to really pay attention to. And that's kind of what we try to do is kind of create this wraparound network for people coming out of prisons and jail. Also, as criminal justice chair of the NAACP, we try to work with the social justice issues where that intersects with our work as well.
I want to thank all of my guests for being on the program today. James Williams is a public defender at Orange County. Heather Thompson's a professor of Afro-American Studies at the University of Michigan. Tamar Burkhead, a professor of law at UNC Chapel Hill. Dennis Gaddy, executive director of the Community Success Initiative. James, Heather, and Tamar are all going to be part of a symposium at the North Carolina Bar Association in Cary. That's on Thursday. It's about mass incarceration. It's at full capacity now, but you can go to our website for any of the information about this and other programs that we do at stateofthings.org. Thank all of you for being on the program. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, a novel exploring the mysteries of dive bar culture on the State of Things. Stay tuned.